problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo Podcast. I am your host, Eric Sufert. My guest on this episode of the podcast is Alan Chappell. Alan is the president of Chappell & Associates, a law firm slash consulting practice that helps marketers build customer trust through responsible privacy practices. Alan has served as outside counsel and chief privacy officer for over 100 technology companies over the past 15 years. Alan and I discuss a number of topics related to data privacy in this episode, including the current state of a potential national privacy law in the United States, what role the FTC might play in regulating the use of consumer data for advertising personalization purposes, the current state of various state-level privacy laws, Google's planned deprecation of third-party cookies, and the conceptual differences in approaches being taken by Google and Apple to protect consumer privacy. Please enjoy this conversation with Alan Chappell. Alan Chappell, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Eric. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I appreciate you agreeing to join. So we did a webinar together at one point. I think it was quite some time ago, maybe 2 years ago, but I don't believe we've ever met in person. Is that correct?
No, I haven't made it to any of your New York City happy hours. I don't think other than that, we've even been in the same city.
There was just the one, which was a huge success, actually. It was like 80 people showed up. It was way too big for the venue, and it was actually like probably a fire hazard. but I was pleasantly surprised. Okay, so I have just introduced you in the introductory segment of the podcast, but before we jump into our discussion, which I have no doubt will be very fascinating and enlightening to me as well as the audience, could you please introduce yourself in your own words?
Sure. So I'm outside counsel and effectively privacy advisor to a whole bunch of ad tech and martech companies. I've been doing it for about 20 years. I was in really early before anybody was really willing to pay for privacy advice. And then over the last couple of years, I started putting out a monthly report, which has sort of become, for at least some large legal teams, sort of the privacy-related Bible for data-driven advertising, because it goes into the strategy and behind a lot of the decisions being made.
Got it. And I don't think I've ever had anybody with your background on the podcast before. I mean, I've had lawyers, and I've had lawyers who specialize in privacy. So I suppose I had Jess Lee on. She works for a big law firm. And so as part of her clients.
And Jess is great. You know, it's funny. I feel like you and I are a little two sides of the same coin, because I view you as a very smart business person who gets a lot of privacy chops. I'm a privacy person who really came from the business side, and I think understands that as well or better than a lot of folks who are focused on privacy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, because I wrote this on Twitter the other day, and I didn't really think it was like self-effacing, but I think maybe some people did think that. But I said, look, I had no idea. When GDPR was like months away from going into effect, the last company I worked at, I mean, as an operator, that's my background, they gave this to me. This landed on my desk as the person that has to sign off on our compliance with GDPR. And I said, what is GDPR? Like, what does that acronym mean? And so that's going back to 2018. So I have no academic exposure to, I don't know, privacy philosophy. I mean, it's so broad-based. There's the philosophy of it. There's the legal aspect of it, right? And then there's the technical implementation of it. So I guess in some sense, I have exposure as an operator to the technical implementation of it, but I never thought about it. And it just wasn't something that I was aware of. And so like in that span of whatever 5 years, it just became much more of a focal point for all operators. But anyway, it was just interesting. And I said that and people are like, oh my God, I can't believe you'd admit that. And I'm like, why would I not want to admit that? That just kind of shows you how accelerated this timeline over which privacy has become a focal point has been. So I think many people are like that today.
Well, right. And also, all respect to the various certification programs out there focusing on privacy. But like, I wouldn't respect your opinion more if you had been certified by somebody, because you took, what, 2 classes in school on privacy? Like, when I went to law school, there wasn't such a thing. I studied human rights law and European Union law, and it turns out that those things are very analogous to privacy. But there wasn't a single privacy class when I was going to school.
Yeah, so I know we're deviating from the questions, but I think this is an important point. One issue I have with what I would describe as like the privacy apparatus or like the professional privacy class is that a lot of them not steeped in anything that's relevant to this. Like, they don't understand the businesses for which, you know, these privacy rules and laws and regulations and platform policies or whatever apply. They don't have legal backgrounds. They just sort of self-certified as privacy experts. I don't want to anonymize this, but I came across somebody one time and it was just, they had written this screed on LinkedIn about how, you know, all digital advertising is offensive to personal privacy and it's a disgrace and blah, blah, blah. And I looked into their background and they had a string of like totally random, irrelevant to the privacy topic jobs historically. And then their education was in animal husbandry. And now all of a sudden they became a GDPR consultant. And I'm like, you can't just self-certify as an expert in something. Other people have to call you that. That's not a label that you can apply to yourself. And when I think of an expert, I think of somebody that has pursued a topic rigorously, probably through an academic lens, but well, it could also just be through personal enrichment and personally directed learning, but in a way that other people recognize by paying them or by giving them some sort of professional kudos. And so just saying all of a sudden, putting up a shingle, I'm a privacy expert, that doesn't mean anything. Yeah, I guess you could do that, but I don't take that seriously. And so like if someone to me says, look, I'm not a privacy expert, but I've done the implementation of this for a consumer tech product, and I understand the law as it relates to the implementation because I had to. I mean, my sense is that person has much more of a grasp of these topics than someone who just argues on LinkedIn and built a website that solicits, you know, people to consult with them. Like that to me, that just doesn't prove anything.
Well, so the analogy that comes to mind is, you know, I grew up listening a lot to New York sports radio. And so the guy who calls in and says that, you know, the general manager of the Yankees doesn't know what in the heck he's doing. He needs to trade blah, 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 and bring in blah, blah, blah. That's sort of akin to the privacy expert posting randomly on LinkedIn. It's a complicated area. And most people who are brand new, whether they mean to or not, really, it's one of those, tell me you're brand new without telling me. When people talk about it, there tends to be a lack of sophistication because this stuff is complicated. It's messy. It involves a whole bunch of balancing of interests. And if you're not doing those things, you're really not doing privacy work.
Yeah. And it's also not clear cut in any meaningful way, right? I mean, these things evolve over time. I mean, take the GDPR. I mean, a lot of the GDPR enforcement that we've seen lately is recent, right? It hasn't been this through line where all of these things have been considered to violate the GDPR since the day it went into effect in 2018. Actually, the enforcement has gotten much more aggressive recently. And then the e-privacy directive, which is even much older than the GDPR. I mean, all of the sudden, that is becoming much more relevant because various state-level DPAs are pursuing it. But like, you can't tell me that this isn't like a fluid dynamic, because it is. And so anybody's just like, no, this is certainly against the GDPR, certainly against the e-privacy directive. Well, okay, that's an interpretation, your interpretation, right? Because there's two aspects of it. I mean, could you prove or could you make the case in a convincing way that some activity or some behavior violates the GDPR, violates the state level implementation or the EU state level implementation of the e-privacy directive, right? Because it's always implemented as EU state level law, domestic law. Okay, well, you can make the case and maybe it's very convincing. Is someone going to pursue that? Does it matter enough that case is brought against that? Those are two very separate things. And you see people on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever saying like, this is obviously a violation of the GDPR and it obviously will be sort of rejected. It's like, well, no, you can't possibly say that because you can't possibly say that both of those things are going to be true without them actually happening.
Yeah, so the e-privacy directive is sort of a textbook case of how complicated EU data protection law is, because the reason there hasn't been a lot of enforcement in the privacy directive, well, okay, for the first couple of years, if you go back to like 2002, there was an open question about whether default browser settings were sufficient to count as consent. And literally that didn't get fully figured out until GDPR, because GDPR basically said, hey, anywhere there's the word consent, the definition is now GDPR's definition of consent, you know, specific and formally freely given. Okay. From an enforcement standpoint, if you are the local data protection authority in, say, Poland, and there is a very prominent Polish publisher who is bringing a lot of jobs to Poland, you are going to be reluctant to come after that Polish publisher because they've got Google pixels or Criteo pixels or whoever's pixels. But the reality is that most of the implementation guidance around e-privacy says that it's up to the website operator to get the consent. but the individual data protection authorities are not going to go after or reluctant to go after the local publishers. I mean, that's really been the story behind the story for e-privacy enforcement. So somebody's really decided they're going to open up a can against Criteo, and it's been really interesting to follow because it's way too early to say this, but I think Criteo may be in a little trouble here.
Well, and on Voodoo Games too, they're French domiciled. Okay, we're 15 minutes in and we haven't even gotten to the first question.
So this is a four-part webinar, right?
Yeah, right. This is part one of 27. All right, so what is the current state of a potential national privacy law in the United States?
Currently dead in the water. We're in an election year. Congress can't figure out what to, you know, order for lunch, let alone, you know, we barely have kept the government open for another, what, 3 or 6 months. So dead in the water. However, what's interesting to me is there's two things that might shift that. And I share this as somebody who I started my privacy practice in the wake of the canned spam law, which not many people remember. But the reason there is a canned spam email law is that there was a horribly draconian law from California, ironically, that was opt-in for email. Everybody freaked out. Congress stepped in and like a month and a half created canned spam. So the thing that's going to drive a potential privacy law, if we have one in the next year, is going to be crazy stuff coming from the states. And I'll point right at Montana and the ban on TikTok. You have enough of that activity, and you're going to see some forces really try to push through a federal privacy law.
Well, you'd hope so. You know, talked about this concept of like the spaghetti bowl of state level privacy laws, and right, like they're all roughly kind of the same, like, or like they're roughly like 80% overlap or something, but they differ in like specific and idiosyncratic ways. And in every place they differ creates a complication for a publisher or an advertiser for compliance. And so what you're going to end up having to do as an advertiser or publisher or whatever, anybody that processes users' data, is you're going to have to construct your infrastructure in such a way that it only deals with the intersection of all of them. So in the places where they differ, you just say, I can't touch that data, right? It could be North Dakota has a very specific rule on specific ways data can be treated. Well, guess what? That is going to have to apply to users in every single state because I don't have the capacity to create this complex web of compliance for people in every state or people domiciled in the state but are traveling to another state or whatever. And so what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to look at only the ways in which they overlap, only the ways in which they intersect and build my infrastructure to service that. And I'm going to have to lose all the edge cases. And that potentially, so even if all of them are roughly the same, if one state differs in a very specific way, I can't treat it as an edge case. I have to treat that as the universally applicable rule for everyone in the United States. So first of all, it just restricts the ways that you can process user data unless you're a very big company, unless you're a massive platform, in which case you've got a team of lawyers, you've got a team of engineers. They can build exceptions. They can build rules into their infrastructure that accommodate those specific cases. Doesn't that just benefit? Doesn't the spaghetti bowl of state level privacy laws, doesn't that benefit the largest platforms?
Absolutely. No, they have more resources to adhere to the laws. They're able to get some of the subtle nuances. So I agree with everything you said. The one thing that I would add to that, though, is consent. The large internet giants are able to operate in a consent environment. And in the US anyway, consent cures all. If you're able to make a straight-faced argument that you have users' consent, a lot of these requirements start to go away. A lot of these other state requirements start to go away. And it's sort of funny because there's a perverse impact of the hyper-focus on consent because you sort of incentivize them to collect additional data. So if you need a consent for an IP address, well, you might as well get a name and an email and a telephone number and additional information. So it's having the actual opposite effect that the privacy side of me would like to have. I'd like to see more data minimization out there.
So when you were saying that the surveillance advertising, we talked about, was that a reference to the Banning Surveillance Advertising Act, the SU, Wyden, Booker, Schakowsky?
Yeah, certain senators in particular, for years, you know, every other year will release essentially the same piece of legislation. It's almost like a little press release that allows them to indicate to a certain subgroup of their constituency that they're doing something. And it's not really an honest argument, but if we're just going to talk about honest arguments when it comes to politics in the US, I think that's also a separate, maybe we have a separate podcast for that. But I'll just point to this. Anybody who releases a federal privacy law with a private right of action is not serious about having that become a national law. One of the most important things about any set of rules is who gets to enforce it. generally speaking, for a federal law, at least a general federal privacy law, it's the Federal Trade Commission that would usually be granted the primary authority. They might be granted some additional rulemaking power so they can create their own specific rules and thoughts around how the marketplace should regulate. In a private right of action, in addition to the FTC, you would allow class action plaintiffs to enforce the law. And the issue I have with the class action bar is that they tend to be rather creative, and they're also a little predatory. And so it's not really about protecting consumers. It's tantamount to just creating a distraction for the business community. And the reason I'm pointing at that particular law is there is no way in the world that gets through just about any Republican member of the House or Congress with a private right of action. So if you were serious about this going anywhere, you would not include that in there.
But some of the state level laws do have private right of action. Is that correct? Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, the one that comes to mind is the Washington My Health, My Data Act. And that's a problem. When you talk about multi-state strategies, you're going to see a bunch of companies just stay out of the state of Washington for a while because the definition of health data is almost comically broad, and it has a class action, a private right of action. California has a private right of action, but I believe that is only for data breaches and not for general CCPA compliance. That's its own thing, but it doesn't impact the data-driven advertising constituency that I normally deal with.
Got it. You made reference to the FTC. So the FTC published an ANPR advance notice of prior rulemaking. Am I remembering that acronym correctly?
They did.
They published an ANPR related to commercial surveillance last year. What do you think comes of that? So that was also very broad, right? And also there was a lot of pushback from within the FTC. Like Noah Phillips, for instance, wrote a dissent, and he was saying, look, we're not a legislative body here. Like, we can't just make law. What sorts of restrictions could the FTC impose? And does the FTC have more agency or flexibility to enact restrictions than does Congress?
So I'm going to bring this back to the 1970s, believe it or not. Because back in 1975, the FTC had a lot more power than it does today. And it was able to create, it had what they call rulemaking authority, specific rulemaking authority that they could regulate the market as they see fit. For better or worse, the FTC thought it would be a good idea to prohibit children's television advertising. And the business community went ballistic. Congress eventually stepped in, stripped the FTC of a significant amount of its power. And from that point on, the FTC's powers, other than those granted via specific laws, is really, really limited to, like, you said X, but you did Y and we caught you. Or we think this behavior is patently unfair to consumers, but even that's not an easy case to bring. Okay, so what they're doing is they're borrowing from a really old process by which they think will enable them to create rules. I'm not here to say they are or they aren't. I will say the current makeup of the Supreme Court, if it's the same once this whole process is complete, that Supreme Court takes a very dim view towards governmental agencies exceeding the ambit of their power. So they're trying to do something. It's not clear to me that they're going to ultimately be successful, but parcel to doing this, I think they hope to raise awareness around the issues that they think are important.
Assuming, let's say that, you know, there's a more receptive, I don't know, because it's not really possible, but like if there's a more receptive Supreme Court soonish, which I don't think there could be, but okay, let's just say they're, you know, I don't want this, it gets into like a morbid hypothetical, but anyway, would they have more agency or flexibility to enact restrictions? I mean, so let's say that they were able to do this, they were able to push this through, like, might they do things that Congress is just like structurally or compositionally incapable of doing right now?
Congress can step in any time if they don't like what the FTC is doing and create laws stopping the FTC, preventing the FTC from weighing in a certain issue. Do I think the FTC might be a better institution to regulate privacy? I would say potentially. I would say that the Lena Khan FTC is certainly almost on the European side of privacy avengership. By the way, I agree conceptually with a lot of what Lena Khan says. I do think that trying to implement this type of what she's trying to do, for one thing, she's sort of operating in a way that's almost Trumpian in that she's literally blowing up established norms and processes within the FTC, which is undermining its legitimacy ultimately. It's going to make the torch that she is trying to carry even more difficult to carry.
That's interesting. So I think I probably agree, right? So I don't know that I would agree that I think that I agree with what Lena Khan is trying to do, because I think she spelled out what she wanted to do in her paper that she wrote, which I read at the time and I thought, huh, this is interesting. The ideas are immature and they're sort of like, they're not fully formed, but with enough time and with enough attention to detail and with enough just intellectual robustness, this could become an interesting new paradigm for enforcing antitrust, because a lot of the rules simply are anachronistic when applied to the big tech platforms. Like, so that I agree with, right? The problem is, I would argue that her conception of the, call it ailments or the ill effects of the just the scale of these platforms have not been made more clear or more robust, or they've not been fleshed out in ways that are incomprehensible. And it feels like she's doing this kind of like jazz improvisational dance. And it's like, we'll just sort of figure it out as we go along. I don't really sense that there is a well-formed, convincing, compelling thesis driving this. It's just that big tech must be de facto bad, and we'll figure out why as we go through the motions of these lawsuits. And the problem is, you can't really make any progress if you're always losing.
Well, that's a great point.
But like, the Washington Generals will never be a championship team, because, or they'll never go into the Hall of Fame, because the Harlem Globetrotters beat them every single time, right? And so I just feel like you've got to put a win on the board. And maybe they need to start with a much more narrowly scoped problem, define that, and then sort of build on that, rather than speaking in the abstract entirely.
I agree with almost everything that you said. I might position it a little bit differently. I think that the last 40 years of the FTC have adopted much more of a Robert Bork type view, where we've moved away from trust busting into something that is probably more protective overall to large companies, as long as they're efficient and you can make some compelling argument that they're enabling consumer welfare and however that gets defined. I would like to see the pendulum swing back a little bit. And I don't think I'm alone in that. Do I think that Lena Khan is either has the goalpost clearly in focus, or do I think that Lena Khan is necessarily taking the right steps? No to both.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. So okay, I think on that point, I'd like to talk about the expanding definition of personal data in the US, and you'd sort of frame this as like de-identification. So first of all, could you just sort of explain what you mean when you talk about de-identification, and talk to me about how you conceive of this expanding definition of personal data in the US?
Yeah, so we'll start with de-identification. And if you think about it just from the perspective of medical data, and you know, for at least 10 years under HIPAA, the idea was is that if you are able to remove anything from a data set that might be used to identify someone, you have de-identified the data set, and then you can use it for things like, you know, research, or even to a certain level, marketing and advertising, provided that the data set remains de-identified. But they focus on identifiability. Now, the internet has sort of blown that concept up a little bit, because like now with the internet with so much data, I don't think anything is perfectly de-identifiable. However, even under HIPAA, even today, it's not perfect that you have to hit. What you have to do is you have to say, we're going to make it commercially impractical for us to use this data set to identify. We're going to promise not to, and we're going to promise that anybody who we send the data to also makes that promise. And that enables you to get outside of the HIPAA rule set with the data that you're using. Okay, now take a look at really every privacy law since GDPR. It goes a little bit before then, but we'll say that. They've now broadened the definition of personal data to include pseudonymous identifiers, a mobile ad ID. Even in some of the state laws, they go as far as to say, if you have lat long coordinates, or if you have absent anything else, or if you have just any type of digital identifier, it's personal data and it's fully subject to our laws. They also have a definition of de-identified. However, their definition of de-identified doesn't get into identifiability of the data set. It goes into linkability to a particular consumer and household. And the net result of that is that you cannot reliably de-identify a data set under California or most state laws. So you've now removed the number one privacy protective measure for the business community from their toolkit right off the bat. And that has some pretty perverse outcomes in my view.
What are those? What would those be?
Well, we're now at the point where like a data set just can't be, you just can't either can't collect the data or you can't use it at all. I don't know how we're going to, you know, what our plan is to do anything with artificial intelligence, but if you don't have an underlying data set, if everything is personal data and you can't touch personal data without jumping through 1,000 hoops, well, then how are you building out an AI model?
Well, yeah, and that's really problematic, right? I mean, if you look at how Europe is trying to regulate generative AI, I mean, that feels very misguided to me. It feels like they just immediately take this hostile positioning towards any new technological innovation because something, something, something could be a vector of privacy risk. And it just feels like, again, it's like, that seems like a very sort of condescending view of the ability for these technological innovations to be safeguarded against privacy violations, right? It's like, there's no way anybody could ever come up with a technical solution to this. And so therefore, we'll just foreclose upon the possibility of this becoming a market or a viable piece of technology, right? And that just seems like a very sort of retrograde approach to regulating things, right? It's like, well, okay, like let's think of ways to implement safeguards and protections. Let's not just write this off. Let's just not foreclose upon the possibility of this becoming a market, because this is the issue. They never want to engage with the actual subject matter experts. They never want to engage with the people that build this stuff because, well, they must be biased, right? They must be biased in favor of it. They're just sort of like rabid capitalists, and they'll never want to implement any safeguards because that might cost them a few cents or something like that. The thing is, there's no partnership. And I feel like, you know, when you see a lot of times the people that go and they testify in front of Congress, they work closely with some of the European regulators, they're almost always academic. You're going to need support from the domain experts to rein in the excesses. Like, I'll be the first to admit, there are advertising technologies and systems that I find morally reprehensible, right? I mean, some of the data brokerage stuff, I do not agree that that should exist. I think it needs to be reined in. I think it's excessively invasive. But the thing is, there probably are ways to reap the benefits without actually exposing users to the harms. And if you just immediately dismiss that as being like wild-eyed or quixotic, then I think you're never going to get any sort of technical innovation. We're just stuck with what we have.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think I'm telling you anything that you don't know. I mean, Europe probably does not have the same culture of innovation that the US does. Some of it is, you know, at least in this sphere, is, you know, they don't really have a First Amendment where that isn't balanced. Privacy is a fundamental right, which left completely unchecked makes it a little bit more difficult to innovate and to make money. And so that's the balance that they've, you know, chosen to strike over there. I wouldn't want it, but that's what they've chose.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about Google.
So you're at a poker table in Brooklyn, and it's a dark room, and Google owns not the building, the entire casino, the table, has all of the money. And just as the cops are about to enter into the building, Google wants to flip over the table and shoot out the lights because they are confident in the ensuing chaos that they will be in better shape than anybody else. And so I think that Google clearly sees the DOJ and some other entities starting to look towards remedies, and they want to reset the whole thing or as much of it as they can prior to those remedies being imposed. So they are under a tremendous amount of pressure over there to paint lipstick on the pig that is the privacy sandbox so as to convince the CMA to not object to their standstill or what the 60 or 90 day standstill period for deprecating third-party cookies.
Right. I want to kind of unpack that lipstick on the pig comment. So, you know, they're fully committed now at this point. They can't change course, right? But do you think they should have pursued a different strategy with this?
No, actually, I think their strategy has been brilliant. I think it's been horribly disingenuous, but it's brilliant. You know, Google does a better job than just about any company I can think of at creating paradigms so that regardless of how things go, Google's going to be in pretty good shape. And they've done that for, you know, at least a decade, certainly since the DoubleClick acquisition.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I look at the privacy sandbox, these are novel approaches, right? I mean, I think they use, in a lot of ways, probably the most cutting edge solutions for protecting privacy. And I just wonder sometimes if that's just not the point, not from Google's perspective, but from anybody else's. So do you remember when they rolled out privacy sandbox for Chrome in beta? It was like 2 months ago or whatever. And like, there are all these news outlets, and the reaction was, oh, great, now my browser's tracking me. They looked at this as like this new incursion. They didn't look at this as displacing the old paradigm of these cookies that were sort of trafficked totally fluidly across every possible third-party ad tech operator. They just thought, okay, and here's one more thing that's happening, is my browser's tracking me. So there's a couple issues here. One is that it's very difficult, unless you're like steeped in this and follow it like day to day, to understand that this is actually like an evolution of the approach, right? This is a very different set of approaches, and they're meant to replace that old approach that, you know, you may or may not as a consumer be familiar with. The other problem, I think, is a little more intractable, and that is, and I call this like the privacy sandbox paradox or something. I wrote about it a while back, but like, anything that is more privacy protective than cookies is almost going to necessitate a more complex technological approach that's going to be harder to understand for a layman or for a consumer. And so like, the harder it is to explain, or the harder it is for a consumer to grasp in like a brief second, like, I think most people understand like what a cookie is. If they don't understand that it's a, like, it's actually like a file that's saved on your hardware, they understand maybe conceptually what it is. But if you start talking about topics API and differential privacy and putting people into groups that are so big, because then it's hard, very hard to identify any single member based on like, you know, a history of, you know, based on some minimal set of groups that they're in at any given point in time, like, there's no, most people are not going to understand that. I mean, you'd have to be kind of a domain expert. And so the harder it is to understand, the more skeptical people are going to be. Anything more privacy protective than a cookie is by definition going to be more technically complex, and therefore more difficult to explain to the end user. And therefore they're going to be more skeptical of it than they probably are of cookies. And so that's where the real resistance is going to be. And that applies not just to consumers, but to the people that write about this stuff and who sort of propagate that viewpoint on it. Does it really even matter at the end of the day? Like, let's say this stuff works perfectly. It was a perfect replacement from an efficacy standpoint for cookies, but it's still just much more technologically complex. Would that be viable?
I'll tell you, because there's one thing that I think that you aren't incorporating in how you're positioning this. Apple has historically been a closed ecosystem, forever closed ecosystem. They impose rules, they stick their middle finger out at everybody, and then they go do what they do. And I don't think any of us predicted exactly how that the mobile marketplace would work, would lay out. Maybe you did. But anybody who's been paying attention should not at all be surprised by ATT and all the steps that Apple's taken. Like, it's a closed ecosystem that has increasingly imposed rules. Okay, compare that to the Google ecosystem. And I'm not talking about the owned and operated. I'm saying like the traditional double-click style. It's an open internet system that has been has tons of interoperabilities and tons of privacy challenges, but everybody sort of understood what the rule set was. And then Google, over a decade, has taken on a larger and larger percentage of that. But what the privacy sandbox does is it's the last step towards going from an open ecosystem to a closed Google-controlled ecosystem. And that is a fundamental challenge. Google is trying to conflate two very important and different things. Privacy protective strategies, privacy enhancing technologies, all good. We should be playing with that. We should be experimenting with that. To our detriment, the ad industry hasn't done enough of that. But then they're also conflating that with Google's closed ecosystem that they control. They can impose new rules whenever they want, and they're the only ones who understand really how it works. And they're able to integrate all of their other products in ways because they understand how it works, and because they've got, you know, most favored nation status. But they're trying to conflate two very different things, so that when I complain about the privacy sandbox, I get labeled as, well, Chappelle doesn't like privacy. And that's a disingenuous argument. And I've been increasingly pointing that out to the privacy sandbox, you know, marketing team whenever I can, that they are not making honest arguments.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point, because that's what everyone's doing right now. It's, and I wrote about this, you know, kind of in the aftermath of ATT, right? I said, look, the sort of unforeseen consequence of this is content fortresses is what I called it. But this idea, it's like, okay, well, look, the data can't flow freely around. We can't transmit the data between parties. That, I mean, tracking transparency, ATT, is a very specific implementation of restrictions. It draws a very bright line between third-party and first-party data in ways that, for instance, like the EU does not, right? But that's a very specific characteristic of ATT. And so how did all the big platforms react? Well, let's just pull all these interactions onto our platform. It's all first-party then. That's FB Shops. That's Meta Shops. That's like, okay, we used to have people click through and go to Shopify stores or go to Nike.com or whatever. No, they have to come to us. they've got to sell on Meta shops and we'll keep the transaction, right? And I just wrote about yesterday about the deal with Amazon and the Meta's deal with Amazon and Snap, and they've done the deal with Snap and Pinterest. I mean, it's basically every social platform, right? So they're just going to say, look, we've got our first party data. What I'm going to do is I'll just say, I'm going to package this up. You connect the accounts, you connect your Meta account and your Amazon account. I know who I'm sending an ad to. I will send the ad that I think they're most likely to click on with the creative. I'll make all that decisioning because it's all first party to me. And I'm not sharing anything meaningful with Facebook. I'm just saying, here's the ad to show this person. And then within your app, you point them to my store. I process the transaction. You don't get that data, but you get incrementally net new demand that is optimized for relevancy. That's just me taking my first party data and playing in your sandbox or whatever. And the first party data all stays within the first party bounds. There's no sort of transmission of third party data. But then it's just, again, it's like the biggest platforms are just pulling all of this into their sort of purview, right? They're just subsuming all of this data that used to flow around and give smaller retailers optionality. They're just saying, no, you got to work with us now, right? Because we're really the only ones that can interface with Meta, or we're really the only ones that have all this transaction data that we can bring to bear on your ad campaigns because we're Amazon, or we're now Meta because we've started offering one-click shopping within our app. We get the data, we can use it for the enrichment of your ad campaigns. So now you have no optionality. You've got to work with us. It's demonstrably happened.
I agree with all of that. I'm going to put a little bit of a privacy spin on this. To all of the advocates and regulators who have been saying for decades that if you just get rid of cookies, all these problems go away, well, congratulations, because you're having almost the same data flows. They're just operating a little bit differently across a slightly fewer number of entities who all have way more data. And you've now removed your ability to audit what's going on because there's no longer a cookie present.
Right. And there's no transparency, right? You can't go and audit Meta's data set or whatever. Yeah. So like with respect to AGT, I mean, that was exactly the point I made when, you know, AGT went live. I had this article that I wrote, AGT privileges Apple's own ad network. Here's how, right? And if you look at the scope of data that Apple uses to personalize ads within the App Store is exactly the same as anybody else would have used to personalize ads on third-party networks for app installs. It's exactly the same. But guess what? They don't have to show the ATT prompt. They show the personalized advertising prompt. They get a lot more screen real estate to explain what the benefits are to the end user, right? And not only that, they have the transaction history because they exclusively process the transactions. So the data transference has ceased, but the data usage stays exactly the same. It's just only enjoyed by one party instead of an open ecosystem, right? It was totally disingenuous to say that did anything to limit the amount of data or the scope of data that was used to personalize ads. It's just one party gets to do the personalization now, and they get to call it personalization, and they get to call it tracking for everybody else. And no one cared. No one cares about that because Apple's built a brand and Apple is considered the consumer's best friend, and no one cared about that. And in places where people even took the time to understand the argument, you know what they said? So what? If it hurts Facebook, I'm happy. And I was like, that is such a narrow view of the situation and a sort of narrow timeline to consider the impacts. Because guess what? Facebook's stock is way above where it was pre-ATT. I mean, they just pulled the content fortress strategy. They're bigger and more leaner and more efficient than ever. And now they have all the data inside their own walls. And if that's what you were trying to prevent, well, looks like you didn't do a very good job of it.
No, it's funny. Going back to the days of Do Not Track, I would have these discussions with people I've known for years who are privacy advocates, and they've really just told me, like, look, I just want all of your clients to go away, so I only have a smaller number of companies that I can deal with. It somehow creates less distraction, less clutter for them. But it's like, okay, but those companies aren't going to engage with you. And if they do engage with you, they're going to engage with you on their terms, and they're going to spin the heck out of it, and you're not going to have any be any closer to understanding what's going on. Unfortunately, small tech companies are the redheaded stepchildren of the space, and just nobody cares what happens to them.
Right, yeah. Okay, I want to ask you one question that I ask of kind of all the privacy experts that I bring on the podcast, which is, this is a fast-moving and, you know, dizzyingly complex space. If I am one of these small companies that has been sort of like forgotten about, how do I keep up, right? So obviously the right answer is, you know, hire Alan Chappell. Does this, like, every company needs an in-house privacy counsel, or they need a privacy product manager? I mean, how do smaller companies follow this and manage to stay, you just tread water?
Yeah, I think every company should engage somebody. We've now moved past that, where most of them have at least a general counsel with some privacy chops. But I've got a number of companies who are, you know, mid-sized ad tech companies that do that. Keep everything inside, but they subscribe to my report, because the problem for in-house people is that you're pulled in so many different directions, even politically, internally within your org, that just keeping up with the changing rule set is really difficult. I think that my report is very helpful in that regard. I know that's incredibly self-serving, but I didn't say hire me, so.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So hire Alan, and the next best solution is to subscribe to his report. Okay, Alan, this was fantastic. I think we could have spoken for another hour. How can people engage with you on the internet? Where can they find you on the internet? Where do you exist on the internet?
From a business standpoint, you can find me on LinkedIn, A-L-A-N-C-H-A-P-E-L-L. Find me on Spotify under my last name, but that's where my music is. I'm very good at that. I might be better at music than I am at privacy. And you can also reach me at Chappelle@gmail.com.
Got it. What type of music do you make? Do you produce?
It's 80s and 90s influence indie rock.
Oh, wow. Okay. What instruments do you play?
I grew up playing the piano, and I've got a full band with violin, bass, drums, guitar. We're pretty good. I've done some stints opening up for Everclear and the Gym Blossoms over the years, and it's a fun thing.
Well, that is an extracurricular activity I don't think I would have guessed that you were involved with. So a very, very interesting factoid. Well, Alan, again, this was a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate your insights, and I wish you a happy Thursday.
Thanks. You too, Eric. Have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks for having me out.